So tonight I'm going to do the second of this series of talks on the eight pillars of joy. I remember last week we talked about the first four pillars, which we called the sort of the more mental, meditative almost principles: perspective, humility, humor, and acceptance. And so tonight we're going to move on to the more heart-centered is what they call it in the Book of Joy. I like to see, as I looked at these closer and closer, I saw that they were more about how we act in the world, how we go out into the world, where we how we find joy in just interacting in the world. And it seemed like that's what these were really all about. So these are forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity. So I want to start by reading something, looking at forgiveness. I want to read something that Bishop Desmond Tutu said. And I've seen various versions of this in other places as well, but it's all pretty much the same. Forgiveness, the Archbishop added, is the only way to heal ourselves and be free from the past. Without forgiveness, we remain tethered to the person who harmed us. We are bound to the chains of bitterness, tied together, trapped. Until we can forgive the person who harmed us, that person will hold the keys to our happiness. That person will be our jailer. When we forgive, we take back control of our own fate and our own feelings. We become our own liberator. It's pretty strong language, but it's a really a clear image. When we're caught in a cycle of anger or fear or some other unwholesome, aversive emotion in relation to someone else or some group of people, it's like we're chained to them and we can't escape. We are bound to them because we keep reliving all those unpleasant, unwholesome mind states when we think about this person or these people over and over and over again. Here we are. There's that story, and we run that story through our mind. Oh my God, they did this, and blah, 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 and the poor me. And it's just unending suffering. But if you can forgive the person or the people or the institution, I suppose, it frees you because now you're not, the story just changed. You're not caught anymore. And I want to be very careful here. And this is a very common misunderstanding of forgiveness. Forgiving someone does not mean that what you're saying is what they said or did is okay or was okay. Or is still okay because they're still doing it in some cases, right? It doesn't mean that at all. And it doesn't mean you should, if you need to, act in a way that deals with this person, forcefully perhaps even. But what it means is that I'm sick and tired of being chained to you. I'm sick and tired of going over this story one more time and feeling miserable. It just doesn't do me any good to be chained. And forgiveness is the thing that breaks the chain. It literally, it's like he had a big pair of, those giant clippers they use to cut chains with, and you snap it. I also want to, of course, point out that this is not easy. Not at all easy. In fact, it can be quite difficult. And it may even be really skillful at the beginning when you're sort of thinking about this, for with some people that you don't you realize it's like, I can't right now, it's just not in me to forgive this person. But everyone can form the intention to one day be able to forgive this person. It's the intention. Remember, intention is the root of everything. It's the intention that's most important, because the intention will lead with practice to the actual thing. So if we can form the intention to forgive, then we'll head towards forgiveness. This is another thing. Yeah, this is also important. So it is totally wrong, he said emphatically, cutting his hand sharply through the air, to say that the practice of tolerance and the practice of forgiveness are signs of weakness. Totally wrong. 100% wrong. Forgiveness is a sign of strength. Ah, isn't that an interesting thought? You know, because usually when you see that, it's like, oh, it seems sort of wishy-washy. I'm letting the person go. And you're not. You're still going to hold them to account if that's what you need to do. But you're not willing to be bound to them emotionally any longer. I'm just tired of it. And I don't want to go there anymore. Okay, so there's another thing about forgiveness, and this isn't necessarily directly from the book, but I spent a lot of time actually studying and practicing forgiveness practices at one point in my life. And that's this, where it says, basically, there are three different layers of forgiveness. Yeah, there's asking for forgiveness, which is also something we need to do sometimes. And think about it, that's a really hard thing to do, because to ask for forgiveness is to basically say, you know, I really messed up. So asking for forgiveness and truly meaning it when you say it is a really important part of this cycle of forgiveness, to be able to actually ask for forgiveness. Is to admit that you're less than perfect. Shocking as that may seem, to actually go and go, yeah, I did something really unskillful there. And it's like, oh, I gotta, I want to do better. And then, so there's asking for forgiveness. Then there's forgiving others, which is primarily what I was talking about. And as I said, this is difficult. Especially, you know, there are some things that people do that are truly horrible. I mean, let's be honest, we live in the world where there are people who are quite abusive in many ways, verbally and physically. And that's difficult to forgive. That's where this idea of having the intention to forgive someday might be really skillful. But we have to forgive others. That's another piece of that chain. Yeah. And then the third part, this is the real hard part, right? Forgiving ourselves. Ah, well, now, this is, I can see everybody's nodding and smiling. It's like, oh yeah. It's like, this is the hard part, because we have these stories we tell about ourselves. You know, when we're talking about, we have these stories about me being the bad person who did this, or I'm always the one who gets angry, or blah, 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 right? These are really harmful mind states that we get caught in. And we start to, if we're not careful, end up defining ourselves by these stories. I'm the person who X, blah, blah, blah. Aren't I a bad person? I'm not worthy. I'm not good enough. You know, all those variations on that theme. But if you can forgive yourself, and then once again, this is, might just be I'm forming the intention to one day forgive myself. I mean, once again, there's some pretty deep-seated patterns here, perhaps. But it's like, if that's the third part, because those are chains, self-made chains. We've wrapped ourselves around in our own chains and locked ourselves up. And we're still chained, but now we've done it to ourselves. We've created our own suffering. And so forgiving ourselves is also a really important thing to do, to have that release. And it, once again, it doesn't mean that you're saying just, oh, well, actually it was okay. No, it wasn't okay. What you did might have been really crappy, really unskillful. But you're a human being and you make mistakes. And it didn't do any good, especially when you see that, to continue beating yourself up about it. You know, acknowledge it, look at it, go, you know, form the intention to do better next time, and then let it go. Learn from it, and then from that learning, change without guilting yourself over and over and over again. Because that does no good at all. Okay, forgiveness. In another place, Desmond Tutu says, if you can't forgive, you can't be joyful. I mean, it's like, that's pretty strong, but he's saying that's in the world, in our way we interact with other people, without forgiveness, there can be no joy. We're constantly getting stuck again and again and again by these chains. Okay, then moving on. Gratitude. The second of these, what I'm thinking of is wholesome heart states. Gratitude is interesting. I came across this interesting quote. The Buddha said there are two things that are remarkably rare in this world: people who benefit others and people who feel gratitude. Remarkably rare. And notice those two things are very tightly bound together. Because when you have gratitude, you naturally want to help others. Look at all I've got. Now I should make sure other people have stuff too. It's like they're a natural pair. Let me read something here. Right. So this is once again from the Book of Joy. I'm talking about gratitude. Neither the Archbishop nor the Dalai Lama spent a great deal of time talking about enjoyment, perhaps because both of their traditions are skeptical of finding lasting happiness through sensual indulgence. But I've been happy to find that neither of them was opposed to the pleasures permitted in their spiritual lives, whether Tibetan rice pudding or rum raisin ice cream. Gratitude is the elevation of enjoyment. Isn't that a great line? Gratitude is the elevation of enjoyment, the ennobling of enjoyment. Gratitude is one of the key dimensions that is the definition of joy. Gratitude is a recognition of all that holds us in the web of life and all that has made it possible to have the life we have than the moment we are experiencing. Thanksgiving is a natural response to life and may be the only way to savor it. Both Christian and Buddhist traditions, perhaps all spiritual traditions, recognize the importance of gratefulness. It allows us to shift our perspective, as the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop counseled, towards all we have been given and all that we have. It moves us away from the narrow-minded focus on fault and lack to the wider perspective of benefit and abundance. Thinking about what we have instead of what we don't have is a cause for joy. Just that is a shift in perspective. Huh? The Dalai Lama's ability to be grateful for the opportunities that exist even in exile was a profound shift in perspective, allowing him not only to accept the reality of his circumstances, but also to see the opportunity in every experience. Acceptance does not mean fighting reality. Gratitude means embracing reality. It means moving from counting your burdens to counting your blessings, as the Archbishop had recommended, both as an antidote to envy and a recipe for appreciating our own lives. In the Dalai Lama's case, what he'd been talking about earlier was how he could, by shifting perspective, look at his life in the last, since he had to flee Tibet when he was like 19 or 20, a very young man, and lost everything, essentially, his palace and da-da-da-da, and all of, most of what he, anything he had, just literally the clothes on his back, and saw his culture and his people profoundly hurt by the Chinese communist government. And that could make someone really bitter. But number one, he forgives the Chinese government, which I think is fascinating. He actually has full forgiveness for them. But more importantly, he looks at it as an opportunity. Look at this incredible opportunity. If I'd stayed in Tibet in that palace and everybody, you know, just been there and being the Dalai Lama and Lhasa in that palace, I never would have got out into the world and met all these amazing people and done all these amazing things and been, because he's traveled all over the world and has made friends with all kinds of amazing people like Desmond Tutu that he just would probably have never met. Never gotten to know. He would have lived this quite cloistered life of the Dalai Lama. Instead, he's had to live this very open and broad life. And he has incredible gratitude for the fact that he's been able to do that. It's different perspective on exactly the same situation. Oh, I live in exile, poor me. Oh, I live in exile, isn't that great? It's an interesting way to shift the mind, I guess, which is what I love about a lot of what they talk about here. Also want to read something from Jack Kornfeld. Jack is big on gratitude. This is actually... he calls it a meditation, but I think it's actually a prayer. But if you want to, you know, close your eyes while I read this and let it sink in that way, feel free to do so. But don't feel obligated to. Maybe you want to take notes on it instead. But this is from his book, The Awakened Heart. With gratitude, I remember the people, animals, plants, insects, creatures of the sky and sea, air and water, fire and earth, all whose joyful exertions bless my life every day. With gratitude, I remember the care and labor of a thousand generations of elders and ancestors who came before me. I offer my gratitude for the safety and well-being I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the blessings of this earth I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the measure of health I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the family and friends I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the community I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the teachings and lessons I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the life I have been given. So it's pretty, I love the last line. My kid comes right up, I offer gratitude for the life I have been given. To have a human body and be able to live in this world is what a special thing, right? So there are a variety of ways you can actually practice gratitude. Now, I didn't want to talk about this a little bit because this is one of those places where there's some pretty creative things you can do. One is to just every day, at the end of the day, just write down three things or five things you're grateful for. It could be like a beautiful sunset, or that bird I saw, or that rum raisin ice cream I had for dinner, or it doesn't matter. But there's things that you're actually grateful for. Because this, it just gets you in the habit of being grateful. Just to write them down. Or even if you don't write them down, so you can just think about it. What am I grateful for today? And see if you can name three or four things or five things to yourself. You can extend this a little further if you want to make this an actual practice and have a gratitude buddy. So you write them down, and in the age of email, this is really easy to do. And just send an email to this other, your gratitude buddy every day saying, these are five things I'm grateful for that happened today. And they'll send you one in return. So you see someone else's gratitude as well as your own, which is just reinforcing. It's I've never done this, but I know people who swear by it. Like this is greatest thing they ever came across. Because it ingrains the habit of gratitude. And gratitude is a state of mind, and we're just training the mind to shift into this other state. As one other thing I've seen done, and it's a story, I'm sure some of you, you've heard me tell this story before. One of the long retreat sites on, a teacher gave a talk about gratitude, you know, a full hour long Dharma talk about gratitude. And at the end of the Dharma talk, he suggested that if we wanted to, we should go back to our rooms and just write down things we're grateful for. Which was actually quite surprising, because this was a teacher who was normally quite strict and who very strongly suggested we don't write or read anything. But he was now suggesting that we actually go back and give them. I would have had to find a piece of paper and a pen to do the writing. But anyhow, that's only a highlight on the story. There was in this retreat this one particular young woman. You know how you can tune into some people, you know, don't talk to them, but just by the way they walked and the way they moved and the expression on her face, she was this sad. She was really sad. She just she walked around with her head hung down, and she was sort of, just the whole energy was there. Every time I saw her, I could feel these waves of sadness coming off her, and I felt for her, but you know. So the next morning, the morning sit after breakfast, this young woman comes in and she's upright and she's smiling and she's just like this whole other person just walked into the room. It was like, wow, what happened to her? You know, I didn't know what it was. And so after the morning sit after breakfast, normally there's a time for questions. So you know, we sit, and then the teacher who actually gave the Dharma talk the night before, because that's what the questions might be about. She has any questions, and her arm goes up right away, and he calls on her, and she says, I took your suggestion to write down things I'm being grateful for. I've written 5 pages so far. Am I doing too much? And the teacher looked at her and he said two words. He said, keep going. All he said. Because obviously for her, this was like a sea change in her life, just to tune in to the good stuff in her life instead of always thinking about all the bad stuff, which is obviously what she'd been doing. It just was a shift of her mind. And you see things like this on retreats, or dramatic things like this sometimes. So gratitude is a very powerful joy producer that we can tune into consciously. And moving on, we move on to compassion. And first of all, this is a dictionary definition of compassion. This is the third of those four pillars. The dictionary definition is a feeling of deep sympathy and sorrow for another who is stricken by misfortune, accompanied by a strong desire to alleviate the suffering. Which is that second part, I think, is actually quite interesting. Because often we think of compassion as the first part, a feeling of deep sympathy and sorrow for another person who is stricken by misfortune. That's empathy. But it isn't compassion, because compassion has the accompanying strong desire to alleviate the suffering. Without that, you have empathy, or you might even have pity, which is what's called the near enemy of compassion in Brahma Vihara practice. It's that state of, oh, those poor people, like you're looking down your nose at those poor people who are suffering so much. Isn't it so sad that XYZ happened? And it's removed if we're not careful. So compassion is has these two components, and we have to be careful that we know both of them. So from the Theravadan Buddhist point of view, here's another. So usually when we hear talk about compassion, the Dalai Lamas from a Mahayana tradition, and in all of the Mahayana and Vajrayana traditions of Buddhism, compassion is sort of at the top of the list of wholesome emotions. In the Theravadan world that I practice and live in, loving kindness is actually the one that's at the top, interestingly enough. And then it's simply said, when you have a heart full of loving kindness and you encounter suffering, compassion naturally arises. It's just what happens. That heart full of loving kindness encounters suffering, and a strong desire to alleviate the suffering just arises. I'll read something from the Book of Joy here again. This is, while everyone agrees that being compassionate is a worthy goal, it is hard for many people to understand or to put into practice. The word compassion, as we have said, literally means suffering with. So what would you say to the person who says, I have enough problems of my own? Why should I worry about being more compassionate and think about others who are suffering? As we discussed, the Dalai Lama began, we are social animals. Even for kings or queens or spiritual leaders, their survival depends on the rest of the community. So therefore, if you want a happy life and fewer problems, you have to develop a serious concern for the well-being of others. So when someone is passing through a difficult period or difficult circumstances, then automatically will come a sense of concern for their well-being. And if there is a possibility to help, then you can help. If there's no possibility to help, you can pray or wish them well. So it's compassion is part of being a social being. It's a natural thing for it to be social. But what is often the case when we encounter someone who is stricken by misfortune is not to have compassion arise. In fact, usually, if we're not careful, the reaction is to turn away, to avoid, because it's unpleasant. And we go, ooh, I don't want to feel that. I don't want to be stricken in that way. We'd rather distract ourselves with something pleasant, which is basically what our culture tells us to do all the time. You know, go find, you know, if you're in an aversive mind state, go find something that'll distract you for a while. You know, go play Word with Friends or whatever it is you do to distract yourself. Me, I watch Star Trek, but you know, everybody needs a little distraction now and then. And in fact, these aversive mind states can come actually include fear and denial that the suffering actually exists. It's like, oh, nah, they're just making this up. Or that it's their fault. Blame casting instead of compassion. If we don't turn away, the other thing that happens is we get angry. We see the suffering and then we get angry. And this is often called righteous anger, right? We get caught in this sort of, I'm so strong and important and I can see how horrible this is. And it never helps. In fact, often it inflames the situation. It makes it worse. You can't help yourself when you or anyone else if you're caught in an unwholesome mind state. It's as simple as that. If you try and help others from a place of anger, you just create the causes and conditions for more suffering and more anger to arise. So that it's not skillful. It's thought of as skillful. But just look what happens, you know, when two groups of demonstrators with different points of view face off against each other. What happens over and over again? Both sides get angry, and sure enough, people are getting whacked with picket signs before you know it, right? It's just the way. It's because it doesn't work. That anger is not skillful. Another piece of Jack Kornfeld. This is from A Path with Heart, his other main book. And he's talking about compassion here. No one says this will be easy. Very true words. Sitting in meditation is difficult, and acting in meditation is equally difficult. It may take years of practice to learn how to enter the family arena or the political arena and stay connected with our deepest compassion. Staying connected takes a particular and conscious effort. Yet what is sacred and what is true is found here as much as anywhere. We may be confused initially because our world is complex. When we sit alone, we face only our own suffering. When we act in our families or in the world community, we must also face the suffering that connects us with all of life. Hundreds and millions of our brothers and sisters live in situations of great injustice and great poverty. At times, the injustice and the sorrow of it all seems overwhelming, beyond our capacity to face. This is the other near enemy of compassion, that's sorrow. where we just get overwhelmed. Yet something in us knows that this too is part of our spiritual life, and that we can respond to the suffering as part of our own, which in fact it is. None of us can avoid tyranny, loss, sorrow, or death. We are all interconnected in the destruction or saving of our planetary environment. We must remember that the world's current problems are fundamentally a spiritual crisis created by the limited vision of human beings, a loss of a sense of connection to one another, a loss of community, and most deeply a loss of connection to our spiritual values. Political and economic change have never been sufficient in themselves to alleviate suffering when the underlying causes are not also addressed. The worst problems of this earth, warfare, poverty, ecological destruction, and so forth, are created from greed, hatred, prejudice, delusion, and fear in the human mind. To expand the circle of our practice and face the sorrow in the world around us, we must face these forces in ourselves. Einstein called us nuclear giants and ethical infants. Isn't that a great line? Nuclear giants and ethical infants. Only when we have found a compassion, a goodness, and understanding that transcends our own greed, hatred, and delusion can we bring freedom alive in the world around us. So that's the essentialness of compassion. That's what he's talking about here. I'll be honest with you, when I actually seriously practiced compassion, I did a long retreat once where I did 10 days of each of the four Brahma Viharas. And compassion was by far the most difficult. It was like draining. I had to be really careful to sort of keep my equilibrium, keep my balance. So we have to understand our limits and be careful. Otherwise we do get just dragged down in sorrow. But it is something we have to, once again, at least form the intention to approach things with more compassion. One last note about compassion, and this is a quote from the Kinti Sutta. The Blessed One is compassionate and seeks our welfare. He teaches the Dhamma out of compassion. That's why the Buddha taught. He saw the suffering in the world. First of all, he saw his own suffering, and he got to the place where he no longer suffered. I mean, when someone asked him soon after his enlightenment who he was, he said, "I'm the one who no longer suffers." But he saw the suffering all around him. And he taught for over 40 years out of compassion for others. That's how important compassion is. It's what brought the Buddha's teachings to the world. Finally, the last of these four, generosity. Dana in the Pali term. And let's spend some time talking about this. First of all, whenever, the Buddha was a wandering monk, he'd wander, then he'd get together with the Sangha at some preset place during the rainy season for their 3-month retreat. And the rest of the time he wandered from village to village and town to town and place to place, a lot of the time, teaching. And whenever he got to a new place, the first thing he always taught was generosity. That was the first thing he always talked about. And there's two reasons for this. One is that anyone, no matter their station in life, their education, their intelligence, their physical ability, doesn't make any difference. Anyone, without exception, can practice generosity. There's no one gets left out of this practice. It's available to all of us all the time. And the second is that dana, generosity, is a direct antidote to grasping. It's like, think about, you know, when you're grasping something, your hand's like this. You make a fist and you grip it and you pull it towards you, right? It's mine. When you're offering something, your hand's like this. It's open and reaching out, handing. It's like a different energy. It's an outward going instead of inward going. It's loose, not tight. So generosity allows us, and this is something I thought a lot about, allows us to start thinking of our possessions, of the things we use or carry on, to carry on our daily lives, not so much as mine, but as just stuff. It's just stuff. It's stuff I have now because I needed to do what I do. You know, I have a bunch of tools because I'm a carpenter, and if I don't have tools, I can't do my job. But it's just stuff. You know? And if we don't think of it as mine, if we don't cling to it, then when we no longer need that stuff, we just pass it on, give it away. You know, there's lots of places you can go and take stuff you don't use anymore. You know, I go to Art Thrift all the time with, you know, recently a carload of stuff that we, you know, pandemic's been great for cleaning out garages and sheds and stuff. We had my whole Subaru wagon, the whole back of it was full of stuff to take off to Art Thrift. And it's also, it feels great. It's like, oh, all that stuff is gone. What a weight. This stuff that I just had, whatever it was. And so generosity also, and this is an interesting thought, increases our ability to feel compassion. Because generosity, when I give to Arc Thrift, I know it's going to be for people who really don't have much, who could actually use the stuff, but who can't go, you know, to Amazon and order it and have it delivered, or they can't go to the store and buy a new one, but they can maybe get stuff at Arc Thrift or similar places. Arc is the one I happen to like. I mean, going there for years. And it's like, generosity can actually literally be an expression of compassion. They're tied together. The other thing about generosity is that it gives us joy in three different ways. It's a three for one. There's joy when we're thinking about doing something generous. When you think about doing something, you go, oh, it makes you feel good, right? Then is the actual act of giving itself. It just feels good because you can see this stuff's going to be useful. And then just thinking about it afterwards, like I'm doing right now. I don't know, 6 months ago I went to Arc Thrift and I'm still thinking about it. And it makes me happy. This is the nature. You know, so a generous act gives you joy in three different ways. Also, it's important that when we give gladly, no regrets. We can't sort of think, oh, I should be giving. It has to be, oh, lucky me, I get to give. It's a shift in perspective. And they, the thing about it is, and this is something that's very true in Theravadan countries, is that we actually have to, when we're giving something as much as possible, literally connect with the person we're giving it to. That makes it much stronger. The anonymous gift is wonderful, but you lose that connection. There's a great story. This is Carol Wilson, one of the people I've studied with several times, tells a story. She's very connected to a Wat in Myanmar that has both monks and nuns, and has been very active in helping this remote village Wat. Sort of, the nuns run a school. She's helped them to help the school. Things like helping them build a good toilet. Really basic stuff, right? So this is a story she tells us that this is about 10, 12 years ago. There was a huge typhoon that came up in the Gulf of Bengal and basically wiped out southern rural Myanmar, which is all river delta and very low lying. And it was just a humanitarian disaster. But the government of Myanmar wouldn't admit that it was a disaster and wouldn't let NGOs go in to help. They'd rather let the people starve than admit that they couldn't take care of them themselves. It was just unfortunate. But Carol, being Carol, didn't bother her. She connected with all her friends and collected a whole pile of money, flew to Myanmar, found someone with a truck she could use, went and bought a ton of rice and stuff. Literally a ton, a lot, to fill this big 5-ton truck full of food and stuff, and then snuck past the checkpoints and drove out into the countryside to this little Wat out in the countryside, and gave the, went to the head, the abbot of the monastery, and said, "No, I've got all this food for you." And he said, "Oh, great, we'll do a food distribution right away, because the people here are starving, because they lost everything, some of them." And Carol's thinking, "Oh, that's great." And he says, and she was like getting ready to sort of leave, and he said, "Oh no, you have to give it to them. That's part of the process. You actually have to be there." And so all these people came from the village, mainly the men would come from each family. And the monks would give them a bunch of rice, and Carol had to be there, and they had to meet them all and be thanked and all that sort of stuff. So this went on. And these were people coming literally they had nothing to carry the rice in. So some of the men would literally take off their shirt and then pour the rice into the shirt and then fold it in the four corners and carry the rice home. This is how bad off they were, right? And she said it was like the most amazing thing she'd ever. She just felt so amazingly wonderful watching these people get something that made them so happy and that they really needed. So that's the first half of the story. She actually did that. Then the next day, the monks went out on Donner rounds, which had been pretty skimpy for a while. I mean, monks in this tradition are totally dependent on the people in the village to feed them. Well, the people in the village didn't have any food, so the monks didn't have any food. So the monks go out, and they're gone quite a long time. And they come back, and they have just like heaping bowls of food that they've been given. And they're all in tears. And Carol asks the abbot, "What's going on? Why are they all crying?" He said they were so happy, as they went out, and every house they went to, the people had prepared food. And not only was each household giving them food, but they had all their children lined up with a spoon, and each child put something in the monks' bowls as they went by. It was like, this is how they were being trained right then and there to continue this practice of Dana. This is how deeply it was ingrained in their culture. And it always struck me as a beautiful story, because it's like, once again, I just telling the story, I feel great. It's not even my story. But it's like, These stories of gratitude are really powerful. Couple other things about generosity. One is that you don't have to give money or material stuff even. Often, especially in our culture and in our world where we all have basic, most of us, at least certainly probably everyone here, have our basic needs met every day. Our time is what we can give. Being generous with our time is often the best kind of dana. You know, if you want to volunteer, these days it's a bit more difficult to volunteer because so many volunteer things are shut down because of the pandemic. But even now there's some that are still operating. But find something that you can do that helps others. And just do it because you want to do it. For no other reason than it's something that needs doing. And it doesn't have to be like a big deal. It could just be like an hour a week someplace at a food bank helping load food into bags or something. It doesn't have to be like some enormous, you know, life takeover thing. But find time to give time to others who need it. There are a million opportunities in this community right here. I live in Boulder, but I mean, in the Front Range community, you'll have no trouble at all finding opportunities, numberless. I mean, you'll have trouble choosing numberless opportunities to volunteer your time to help others. It's one of the best things we can do. And if you, it really is an act of generosity. Finally, one last aspect of generosity I want to talk about. And that's, where does generosity sort of fit in terms of our practice, our formal meditation practice? I think it's incredibly generous to take part in a sangha, to go and sit with others, even if it's electronically like this, because it encourages others. You know, I mean, I know I've gone to, you know, because I have a regular sangha I go to. I've gone sometimes and it's like, oh God, how am I going to, I had a tough day. I'm tired. How am I going to get through this? And, you know, you have low energy. And then you sit and there's all these people sitting around and they're very still and they're very quiet. And it's incredible how much energy you get just from sitting with those people. And on the other side, other times, exactly the opposite. You go in and you're feeling great, but you know there's other people there who are struggling, who are just going, oh God, what am I doing here tonight? And that's something we can all give each other. And that's what part of what Sangha is about. And that's why Sangha is so important, I think, is that it's that opportunity to give to others. It isn't just something we do, it's something that we can do out of generosity towards others. And think of it in those terms. And it costs us nothing. Beauty of this form of generosity. So that's the end of this, the eight pillars. And I just want to remind you of them all here. So perspective, humility, humor, acceptance, forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity. And the thing that I've come to realize reading in the Book of Joy and just thinking about it and reading other things is they're all very intimately interrelated. You know, they feed off each other, they connect to each other, one leads to the next, one supports the other. They're not like eight separate things. They're like pillars. So pillars hold up a roof. Right? There's only one roof, and all these eight pillars are all working together to hold up the roof of joy in our case. And the other thing, there's two other things, none of them require any stuff. Think about these things. None of these, we don't have to, get anything or buy anything or have anything. They're just all free. They're just there for anyone who wants them. And this is, I think, equally important, these are all practices. These are all things that we have to practice. We have to cultivate joy by cultivating the eight pillars. That gives us the opportunity to be more joyful. And that's, I think that's the beauty of it to me, is that it is something we can practice in our daily lives and in our formal practice. And it doesn't require that we have anything other than the intention to do so. We just form the intention and then we do the practice. So simple in its way. And of course, so difficult to actually do because of our old habits of mind. But let's think about them as, I can be more joyful just by these simple practices. Don't need anything other than perhaps other people to be with in Sangha. That's the other part. So that's all I have to say. As usual, I've run out of things to say. So I'm going to, as usual, open the floor to comments, thoughts, questions. And all you need to do is turn on your mic. I'm going to make sure I can see the mic's turning on. If you have something to say, just go ahead and turn on your mic and speak. Yeah. So Penny, go ahead. You have to unmute your mic, Penny.
Oh, okay. I'd like to recommend a book. It's called Happy for No Reason. And it's got some of the most touching stories from all around the world that this lady has written. And she started out a very depressed person and she wrote this book. But one of the stories, some of them just made me cry because they were just so beautiful. But one of them stood out, if anyone would like to hear it. It's like, there. It was in India. There was a man who was not paraplegic, but, you know, he had lost both legs and an arm. And he would scoot himself. Have you heard this story?
No.
Okay. Well, he would scoot himself around on this little cart close to the ground, kind of like the thing a car mechanic would get to use to get underneath the car. And every day he'd be at the bus stop, and when the bus stopped, people either on the ground or on the bus would pick him up and haul him in. And he had the most radiant, joyous face and, you know, smiles and stuff. And this lady had said, the author of the book, she said to him, you know, how is it that you're so happy? And he said, well, every day people have the opportunity to help someone, and it makes them happy. So, it just, you know, valued back and forth between those, you know, between him and the people that would help him. So,
yeah, that's great. Thank you, Penny. That's actually something I forgot to mention about generosity, and that's that. Part of generosity is allowing other people to give you things. It's an incredibly generous thing to allow others to give. You know, often when someone offers us something, we go, you know, I don't really want that, or I don't need that, or someone else could, you know, would be better off if that went to somebody else. If someone offers you something, just say thank you and take it. And then if you really don't want it, then it goes into the next art thrift trip or whatever. But it's like you're giving them the opportunity to give. It's an incredible gift of generosity you can give to somebody else. As Penny was just describing in that story, that was this man's attitude. It's like, oh, now I can let other people help. And it gives them, makes them happy. It's true. You know, they get, those people all got to have those three moments. Some people, we're coming to the stop where that guy needs help. Oh boy, they're already, you know, feeling good about it. Then they help them and then they think about it later in the day. Oh, it's not, it's really important that we allow other people to be generous. Thanks, Penny. Thank you for reminding me, Penny. That was great. Okay. Other people have anything to say? If not, I of course have a poem I want to read, but what a surprise. Huh? So this is from Mary Oliver's Why I Wake Early. And it's a bit longer poem than I often read, but it's apropos to the eight pillars of joy, I think. So it's called Bone. Understand, I'm always trying to figure out what the soul is and where hidden and what shape. And so last week, when I found on the beach the ear bone of a pilot whale that may have died hundreds of years ago, I thought maybe I was close to discovering something, for the ear bone is the portion that lasts the longest than any of us, man or whale, shaped like a squat spoon with a pink scoop where once in the lively swimmer's head, it joined its two sisters in the housing of hearing. It was only 2 inches long, and I thought the soul might be like this, so hard, so necessary, yet almost nothing. Beside me, the gray sea was opening and shutting its wave doors, unfolding over and over, its time-ridiculing roar. I looked, but I couldn't see anything, though it was through its dark knit glare. Yet don't we all know the golden sand is there at the bottom, though our eyes have never seen it, nor can our hands ever catch it, lest we should shift it down into fractions and facts, certainties. And what the soul is also, I believe, I will never quite know. Though I play at the edges of knowing, truly knowing, our part is not knowing, but looking and touching and loving, which is the way I walked on softly through the pale pink morning light. Looking and touching and loving, which is the way I walked on softly through the pale pink morning light. Sounds like joy to me. Let's dedicate the merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.